Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work.
Yeah, we did. We went digging into the ground, and we burned many, many things we found. This is Harvey Wasserman back for another hour in Solartopia with the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. That was Dar Williams singing with the magnificent Pete Seeger and David Burns the Solartopia song on the Tomorrow's Children Grammy-winning album from Appleseed Records. Back for another hour, we are rejoined by our guest from last week, Steve Rosenfeld, political editor of the Alternet website, one of the most influential of the websites on the internet left. Steve, are you with us?
Oh, yeah. Hey, thanks for having me back.
All right, great. Glad you're back. You are in sunny San Francisco, and I am in, well, I don't know if San Francisco is so sunny, actually. I came to a recent conclusion. I love San Francisco, probably as much as any city in the world, but I came to the conclusion recently that I could never live there. I mean, the weather in the summer is really bad.
Yeah,
anyway,
yeah, you have to escape. You have to escape to where the sun shines. But, you know, it's...
Well, like to Berkeley. You can drive across the bridge at least and get some sunshine. So, listen, we got a ton to talk about. You have written, you are extremely prolific. And one of the things I like about your writing is that you write about many, many different things. We were primarily talking last week about the Brennan Center of New York City's and New York University's report on stolen elections.
Right.
And I think we came to the conclusion that they came to the conclusion that things are pretty grim in the electronic vote count department for 2016. Do you want to comment a little further on to what we talked about last week?
Yeah, you know, there's a few new things to add, of course. Well, the big picture is this. Nobody would be surprised to hear that after a couple years, one's computers or laptops or even phones become outdated, right? Well, the same is true with the computers that are used in voting machines. And most places around the country bought a new generation of voting machines. There are, you know, different flavors of these. Some have paper, some are all electronic. But they basically did it after 2002. So the life of these machines and their software and their interfaces, literally, you know, if it's a touch screen, you touch here and it records something into a memory thing there, and the way the memory thing then tabulates it someplace else, and then sends it by, you know, Wi-Fi or whatever, you know, a modem to a central, you know, the county counting office. All that stuff is old. It's old, it's unreliable, and there's no replacement in sight. And that's what the Brennan Center, the Brennan Center is a public interest law firm run out of NYU, New York University Law School, and they are heavyweights in the sort of democracy department. You know, they're run by people who used to be the head of the ACLU. They file all kinds of lawsuits around the country, and it's not just in the area of elections. You know, they're a liberal public interest law firm, and they have said that this is a mess, and it could be a real mess if we have a close election, because as everybody knows who follows elections, when things get close, things get weird.
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed out that the Brennan Center are heavyweights. These are not your fringy guys. And what they're saying, you said last week, which I have repeated a number of times since, that election officials somewhere in California are writing to eBay.
So I know these people. You know, I have worked with some of these people, you know, in the intervening years when I haven't had, you know, journalism gigs. Yeah, so what's happened is most of the software and most of the voting machines are run by laptop scale, you know, computers. And a lot of them are basically, you know, Windows XP. They're like, the software is more than 10 years old. And the hardware, the firmware, is, you know, it's more than 10 years old. So what some of these election officials are doing is they are going online and they're basically trying to stockpile spare parts. And there's one guy, Neil Kelly, who is the registrar of Orange County, California. Now, Orange County, you know, that is like the hotbed of right-wing. It doesn't get more right-wing and Republican in California than Orange County. He has basically gotten military surplus wiring to replace, you know, the way, like, you know, so, you know, the internal guts of his machines. And it's not just one machine. It's hundreds of machines. And he, this is not unique. And what actually happens is, you know, the people who are following this in the public policy world, the arcane, nobody pays attention to us world of election geeks, they are applauding him, like, oh, my gosh, what a wonderfully, you know, ingenious response. And,
right.
Yeah, and it's not just him.
And these are the voting machines that are going to decide who will become the next president of the United States, who will become the senators, the congresspeople, the
yeah.
mayors, the dog catchers, the whole bit. Our whole government is now being determined by the whims of totally obsolete computers.
I mean, look, sorry, this computer is screaming at me. What the Brennan Center found in a typical national election, presidential election, which is always the highest turnout elections, you get anywhere between like 130 and 140 or 145 million people. That's what it's been in the last couple of presidential elections. So what they said is that they look across the country and they say that the equipment in places where 40 million registered voters are likely to vote, and there are states that represent 387 out of 538 electoral college votes, are the ones that have, you know, machines on the brink. That's the magnitude. And some of these states are completely irrelevant to, you know, because everybody knows how they're going to vote. But some of them are not, like states like Virginia and your state, Ohio. You know, once again, Ohio. So, you know, this is why it makes a difference. And, you know, your Secretary of State was quoted in the report saying, yeah, the stuff's getting old. You know, the Secretary of State in Missouri was saying, I don't want to be another Florida. I mean, it just goes on and on. But nobody, here's the bottom line, nobody in Congress wants to pay a penny to fix this. And the other thing that's new that's happening is that people are saying kind of in a knee-jerky way, well, let's just vote on the Internet. Of course. What's the problem with Internet voting? Well, the problem with Internet voting is you can't have a secret ballot and have Internet voting. Because the reason is, if you go to an ATM, like, and, you know, the bank ATM makers, they were making voting machines, you have this identifying security information to make sure that your card and your accounts is all kosher, and it's nobody else's, there's no, you know, banking impersonation fraud or theft or anything like that. If you cannot anonymize that with voting and have a secret ballot without introducing the possibility that somebody somewhere along the line can mess with the numbers. There's no way to have both. You can have one or the other.
We're talking with Steve Rutherfeld, a politics editor at Alternate, and the issue of electronic voting in the 2016 election is the great white whale here. I mean, no one is discussing it. No one's really faced up to it. The Brennan Center report, you know, it made some news. It got around, and now it's gone, and nobody's doing anything about it. There's been no mass uprising crusade in Congress or at the grassroots or from the Bernie Sanders campaign to actually deal with this issue. If anybody should be dealing with it, it's probably Hillary Clinton.
Well, you know, I'll tell you something about this. This is where it gets into the weeds, but it does get a little interesting. You know, your listeners probably don't know this, but or maybe some do. But after George W. Bush stole the election from Kerry in Ohio, you and Bob Petraeus and I and a bunch of other people, you know, did a lot of investigative reporting, and we knocked out a lot of articles, and we wrote a book that was published by the New Press that was basically contained, you know, as much all the documentation possible. And the Democratic Party in 2008 paid attention to that. They didn't want to see the same thing happen again. So what they did was they were paying attention to who are the contractors. Because if, like, a contractor goes in and something funny happens, they want to make sure that they can quarantine which counties, you know, might be problematic. They want to be able to sort of not let this thing spin out of control. So what's happened, you know, so, it, you know, because what's ended up happening is the galaxy of known problems that we were discovering after 2004 have become pretty well known. But so now we're fast forward to, you know, we're in 2015 and we're thinking about 2016, a long time since 2004. And so what ends up happening is Hillary's law is associated with her campaign, and her are associated with some election law experts who basically have filed a bunch of preemptive suits in a bunch of states, I think including Ohio, to go after things like some of the new voter ID laws and some of the stuff that basically would, you know, suppress the count or suppress turnout if it's going to be close. Now, that's a smart thing to do, and it's kind of under the radar. But I know people like Bernie Sanders, for example, don't want to talk about this because a lot of people believe that if you talk about how the election is going to be stolen, you're going to reduce turnout. And,
well,
you know,
it's insane.
That's the thinking.
Yeah, I just don't get it. And one of our colleagues, John Simon, wrote a book called Code Red, and in which he talks about, he kind of tries to analyze the psychology of why the Democrats will not deal with election theft.
Yeah.
And, you know, he ties himself in knots trying to understand it. It makes no sense.
Yeah.
I mean, do you have to, like, go into an election thinking that you got to win by 10 million votes? I mean, we think that's why Obama was elected, and they let him stand in 2008 because, you know, his margin was well over 10 million votes. It wound up officially around seven.
That's exactly what has to happen. And, you know, that's exactly what has to happen. You can't win by, and this is the thing that I've noticed over the years, that, you know, in the absence of any real push to have more accurate voting machines and more accountable and auditable process, the only thing that matters is winning by large margins, because all the funny stuff, all the lawyering, all that nonsense comes in only when the count is close. I mean, if you think about it, just forget about Bush v. Gore. Think about when Al Franken, you know, was first elected to the Senate and he was being challenged by Norm Coleman. What were they doing? They were going before that state election oversight board, and they were fighting over which ballots were going to be counted one by one. Because, you know, because they thought, well, we can maybe knock off a couple hundred here or a couple hundred there, or or they'll fight over, well, were the college students who voted, you know, like state residents, or did they get the overseas ballots in on time, or do they have to, like, make some exception because there are the military and they don't have to pay attention to registration deadlines because they're so patriotic, and, you know, and who's going to fight that? I mean, this is the nonsense that happens when it's close, and that's why when you say you've got to win by millions, it's true.
Well, what a sad state of affairs. I mean, it should be that the person who gets the most votes wins. So are we saying that the Democrats are just going to accept going into the 2016 election with a handicap?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, you know, the answer to that is yes and no. It kind of depends on the states. I think bigger things end up being in play, personally. I mean, look, if you have an inspiring candidate...
Well, who would that be in the Democratic side? Where do we have an inspiring candidate? We have Bernie Sanders. He's a 73-year-old Jewish guy from Vermont. And then we have Hillary Clinton, who puts you to sleep in about 30 seconds.
Well, the only thing I can say about... Yeah, listen, and it's even worse on the Republican side, because if you... You know, there are only... John Dean we posted a piece on Alternate that I, you know, John Dean writes, who was Nixon's, you know, attorney until he resigned in the middle of the Watergate scandal. He's made a bit of a career writing these books about how dysfunctional conservatives are. And, you know, he has titles like Conservatives Without Conscience and things like that. And he does these psychological profiles of what he considers to be dictatorial, you know, political personalities. He called Scott Walker worse than Nixon and, you know, more Nixon than Nixon, stuff like that. Anyway, he wrote a piece about 2 weeks ago that said only two of the Republicans who are running have any idea what the president actually does. Not what they think a president does or imagine, but what, you know, how a White House works. And that happens to be Jeb Bush and John Kasich. Everybody else is completely clueless. So,
right. So
the thing about it is, you know, we're not talking about, so this is like who the establishment gets behind. Because what does that mean? It means these are the guys who know how to make the wheels of government turn to benefit business, you know, to push this law or yank that law or, you know, or protect this investment or, you know, or ignore that debt, you know, all that kind of nonsense. And, you know, so these are the guys who, that's the inside advantage. And it's Kasich and Bush who are seen as being like the, quote, you know, more mature people in the party. Now, they're totally boring. Well, maybe Kasich's not as boring as Bush, and you know about him better than I. But, you know, Kasich, Bush, Hillary Clinton, these are not, you know, these are not like scintillating personalities.
Well, you know, there is one interesting dimension to Hillary. I mean, we're talking horse race, but which is kind of fun in a certain sense. I mean, we are Americans after all. Everybody loves a horse race. The thing about Hillary running for president is she'll have Bill along with her. And Bill is, you know, Bill is endlessly entertaining. I think he was an abominable president. There's a lot about him I really dislike. But he is, you know, he has just radiates charisma, and he will be running with Hillary, and that will be, I suppose, their ace in the hole. He was very effective for Obama when he actually turned up for him.
Yeah, he kind of saved Obama during that one convention by giving this speech that made everybody realize that why they should vote for the guy.
Yeah, and, so, you know, he's the only guy, he's the only major candidate that has any charisma at all, I think, aside from Trump. I mean, you have to concede that lunatic though he might be and offensive though he might be, he does have some charisma.
Well, yeah, my favorite conspiracy theory so far of this entire campaign is that Trump somehow had a conversation. I mean, it is true. Trump somehow called Bill Clinton and told him that he was going to run before it became public. And I can only imagine, you know, Bill Clinton in a very sly way saying, okay, Donald, you got to, I understand, you got to do what you got to do. Man's got to do what a man's got to do. And it's like, if that's anywhere nearly, partially, slightly true, it's just the most brilliant stroke, you know, unleashing Bill Clinton unleashing Trump on the Republican Party.
Well, except, of course, you know, these things do have a way of coming back to bite you. I mean, I it's my presumption, and has been, that the Republican Party would never allow Donald Trump to get nominated. But, you know, who knows? I mean, what if it happens and he goes ahead and beats Hillary?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, the thing is, I did a story interviewing this one sort of renegade Republican National Committee member who's on the Rules Committee, and he's from North Dakota. And he basically says that the rules to nominate, you know, in 2016 were set up for an establishment candidate like Jeb Bush or Scott Walker. And he says that you know, there are plenty of opportunities for these rules are really strange. And if you break them down, he says now, and nobody wants to pay attention to this, that the only thing you're really electing in the primary season are delegates who show up, you know, and at the national convention. And once the national convention starts, until they adopt convention rules, anything can happen, which means, you know, they could ignore the results of the primary. That's when you could have, the mother of all floor fights and pick, you know, a consensus. But, you know, will the party allow that? Probably not. Do people fantasize about this? Definitely so. But there are, you know, there are ways that if they were really dead set against nominating Trump, they could use their own rules. And this is what this guy told me. You know.
Yeah, well, that's my presumption is that'll happen. So then I think he's just too much of a loose cannon. I still think that the nominee will be Jeb Bush, but you know, we're talking horse racing. Maybe after we do that, which is it's so much fun to do, and we'll talk about substantive issues. But I think that Clinton, probably if Bill Clinton had a calculation, it was that Trump would really screw up the Republican Party. They would deny him the nomination, and then Bill Clinton would raise a few $100 million for him to get him to run for as a third party candidate, which is how Clinton won in '92. When Ross Perot ran. I mean, it's the only way, the only reason Bill Clinton ever got in the White House was because of Ross Perot. And I think the calculation would be that that's the only way Hillary wins is if Trump runs third party.
Yeah, well, it's possible. You know, I mean, the thing is, these third party candidates historically never really crack 20%. I mean, think of Perot, think of John Anderson. You know, so those are the numbers that you kind of that you kind of end up getting. And anyway,
the other instance of this goes back to Woodrow Wilson and Teddy Roosevelt. And you know, Roosevelt was the extremely popular. It's a funny moment in 1904. Roosevelt had been president because William McKinley. He was William McKinley's vice president. I think we need to rename William McKinley, by the way, William Denali, but that's another story. So William McKinley was shot in 1901, and Teddy Roosevelt was president, and then he ran in 1904. And when he won in 1904, he blurted out, and nobody could believe he said it, including himself. He said it, and then he completely slapped himself around, but he said he would not run again in 1908. And so when 1908 came around, he went to Africa and shot half the animals in Africa, and then, you know, just got sat on his thumbs and finally ran in 1912. Now, what happened was he won the primaries. He William Howard Taft was the incumbent. Everybody wanted Teddy Roosevelt, and he was really the legitimate victor, as I would assume, if the primaries run their course like it seems, that Trump would win the primaries. But then they got to the Republican convention, and the party regulars stole it from Teddy Roosevelt, made Taft the nominee, and then Roosevelt went out and ran anyway, and they split the Republican vote, and that's how we wind up with Woodrow Wilson. So, you know, I guess that's the scenario that probably the Clintons have in mind for Donald Trump.
Well, maybe, who knows, and in the meantime, you know, what's going to happen is we have, you know, we're going to have a more extreme Congress, which is going to make candidates who are more milquetoasty and reliable and predictable, like Hillary, seem more attractive. Because, you know, it actually plays into their favor. And, you know, and I just don't, you know, I want Bernie to be successful. I'm just waiting and watching to see what happens. I can't really predict. I think he's done.
Oh, he clearly has tremendous stamina. I mean, I got to hand it to the guy. He's 73. He's out there on the campaign trail every day. He's raising a ton of money, which is what Obama did in 2008. I mean, I never gave Obama a chance. I thought that he'd win when he first nominated, went out there. But he raised a ton of money through the Internet. Bernie's doing the same thing. And, you know, he's drawing huge crowds. I just can't imagine him winning the presidency. It's just so counterintuitive.
Yeah, I was his press secretary when he got elected to the House in 1990. And, he's not the same person he was then. He's much more sophisticated. You know, he's much smoother. You know, in many ways, his message is, it's the same, but it's definitely evolved. But, you know, Bernie doesn't like to run negative campaigns. And one thing I can tell you is, at a certain point when the Clintons get spooked, they are not afraid to do dark stuff. And I saw it all against Obama in 2008, and I can only imagine what it's going to be like. I mean, I can only imagine.
Yeah, well, I don't know, but and then now they're all talking about Biden, and Biden's also 73, or somewhere thereabouts.
But that's just the press. That's just the press getting silly, because it's like, you know, it's, you know, these, it's one thing for the press to get excited and say, oh, you should run, and then if you actually have to do it, it's, let's.
Yeah, I mean, it's a nightmare. He's too old. I'm just amazed that Bernie can do it. You know, Reagan was only 69. Reagan was only 69 when he got elected the first time, right? I mean,
yeah.
You know, these guys, they're making Reagan look young. Hillary's no spring chicken either, for God's sakes. I don't know how old Trump is. He must be in his 60s, right?
Yeah, I think late 60s.
So, you know, he's not young either. It's amazing. I mean, the youngest guy out there who's got any chance at all, or so it seems, is Rubio. I think Rubio is you know, late 40s, maybe. But
yeah, that's right. He's in his 40s.
Kasich is in his 60s as well, I believe. So, you know, it's amazing that we don't have anybody young out there who's really got any kind of deal. You did write an interesting analysis, which I'd like to make sure we cover here, which is why you think Scott Walker was doomed. I was so glad. The sight of Scott Walker turns my stomach, and the same with Chris Christie. I mean, I'm not a big fan of these other people. Carly Fiorina is getting there for me, but when I look at Chris Christie on TV, I get nauseous. And the same is true of Scott Walker. Why don't you tell us why you think he was doomed to start?
Well, I just thought, you know, early on, a lot of people at Alternet, people who work, you know, in like, you know, alternative media, you know, Wisconsin, the Progressive, everyone was just scared to death of Walker. And I just thought that he was too unpolished, too much. He was almost, you know, he was almost like a cartoonish cliche for everything that ALEC, which is the American Legislative Exchange Council, the sort of right-wing, you know, legislation-producing, you know, house, and, you know, and what the, you know, and like the Koch brothers, what they really wanted. You know, it, you know, there was no conservative bill, you know, there was no conservative cliche that he wouldn't embrace. And when he got a little bit off message, he said a lot of really dumb things that really showed that he was not ready for more prime time. So there's a whole bunch of those things. I mean, he went to England, you know, as if he was on some, quote, state economic development trip, right? It's just, you know, it's just another fiction. And, the British press started giving him a hard time about evolution. And he couldn't answer their questions. And there were,
yeah.
And then he came back and he said, well, if I could face down the protesters, you know, the union mobs, you know, pro-union mobs, you know, then I can beat ISIS, which is just patently absurd. And now, in the last couple of weeks, there have been these articles in that have come out of, you know, in Wisconsin, Milwaukee. His hometown paper said, have published pieces saying that he was hiding during that whole, you know, all those protests. You know, his book had the insanely, you know, pompous title of Unintimidated. And here was, you know, here former Republican legislative staffers were talking about how much he was hiding.
Yeah.
So he just had a lot of, you know, the other thing is this, sometimes the national media goes crazy over really stupid stuff. So, you know, you have this like right-wing farm forum in early January in Iowa. Now, he was born in Iowa. His father was a small-town preacher. These are his people. He knows how to be comfortable with them. So all of a sudden, you know, they have a straw poll and he's in the lead. And then the Washington Post considers him like, you know, the guy to beat. But there's nowhere to go but down. I mean, this is 22 months before the presidential election, and 13 months before the Iowa caucuses. I mean, how do you sustain that when our attention spans are, you know, like the size of a tweet, you know? But mostly I thought he was just too raw, too coarse, too unpolished, and it turned out, you know, to be right.
Well, there's also another dimension. He's not a particularly good-looking guy. And he didn't really look like he knew what the hell he was doing. He looked like a deer in headlights, mostly.
Yeah.
Very clearly out of class. I think that's true of Huckabee. Huckabee looks like his name, actually, kind of a down-home doofus, you know. And I read a column today. I like Dave Zirin a lot, Z-I-R-I-N. He writes about sports. And, you know, Jeb Bush gave a totally tone-deaf response on why they shouldn't change the name of the Washington football team. And he compared it to the Florida State Seminoles, which is completely ridiculous. I mean, Seminoles is a tribal or national name, and the racist name of the football team in Washington is completely different. And you know, Jeb Bush is really not so smart, but he still does look like he could be president. Now, I don't think Scott Walker had any kind of that look. And I think Kasich, I know it's stereotypical, Kasich really looks like a vice president to me. And we know Kasich. Kasich is very capable of sophisticated thought. He's been in this a long, long time, and he's always been very aggressive. One thing about Kasich, you know, I disagree with him on just about everything, but he doesn't hide from issues. And he did an interesting thing today, actually, and maybe even because we've been attacking him. The Ohio, under the previous governor, passed a very, very progressive and a very comprehensive transition bill for green energy. Yeah. And then Kasich came in, and the Republicans in the House, in the Ohio legislature, just slaughtered it. And, they, you know, this was one of the best bills in the country. And they just tore it to pieces, and they did this ridiculous thing. They said they're going to put it on hold for 2 years and study it. And they came out today or yesterday and said that, you know, they want to rescind the targets for renewable energy in Ohio. And, you know, where we burn a hell of a lot of coal and there's fracking all over the place.
Right.
And two deadly nuclear plants. And Kasich came out and said that he was against that he wanted to actually propose a bill, which I'm sure he'll do, to the legislature that will actually reinstate renewable energy goals. Now, they'll be very, very low. But what he's done is, I mean, you know, I wrote several pieces calling him the most anti-green governor in the United States, and now he's undercut that. You know, it was a very smart thing to do. I doubt Scott Walker would have had the brains to do that, but this is or the daring, but this is Kasich's strategy, and I think actually he's ideologically he's fairly formidable.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, he's one of the few Republican governors who allowed Obamacare to expand, right?
Yes, I mean, and he also saved Medicare, Medicaid.
Medicaid. Yeah.
And so, and he did. I'm waiting for him to do this. He's going to do something because when he came in, there was a $400 million grant that had been won by our side to restore train service between Cleveland, Columbus, and Cincinnati. And, you know, this is a real – he can be really a jerk, Kasich. And he came in and he just arrogantly, without hearings, without anything, threw the money back at the federal government. So it was a waste of money. We're not going to restore train service. When he runs, he's going to be challenged somewhere along the line about what he's going to do about it with Amtrak. And, you know, Amtrak is not unpopular. Millions of people ride Amtrak on both coasts. And I'm waiting for him to do some kind of two-step on train travel. You watch. At some point, he's going to do some kind of little undercut the opposition on it and say that, what he'll say is that was the wrong program, and he's going to come up with some way to defuse his opposition to train travel. You watch that.
You know, it's interesting you say that. Yeah, it's really interesting you say that because, I mean, you know, these are ideologically driven decisions that, you know, then all of a sudden, like, okay, we'll find some way to justify it. I mean, but the thing is they hurt ordinary people. They make life tougher. And unnecessarily tougher. Chris Christie did the same thing. One of the first things he did when he became governor was canceled what was going to be another tunnel between New York and New Jersey. And, you know, this affects millions of people. And it takes these things, you know, unfortunately, they take years to come together. And
it's awful.
And
I have a daughter who lives in Teaneck. And, you know, getting over to George Washington Bridge every day is a nightmare. And it's completely unnecessary.
Yeah, so the thing about this is, you know, at a certain point, all this posturing will start peeling away, and people will be smart enough to really say, you know, how is this helping? You know, who is this helping? Who is this hurting? And this is interesting. You know, there's a new book that came out by Robert Reich. He's really prolific. And, you know, the former Clinton labor secretary.
Right.
And now he's, you know, he's, and in it, he's a smart guy. And in it, he basically just put a label on things that we're really feeling about what's wrong with the economy and what's wrong with modern capitalism. And basically what he says in his new book is that we're living in a new era of monopolies in America. And if you think about it, you know, like when you try to, you know, you see it, you know, with the Apple operating system, you see it with phone companies, you see it with healthcare, you see it with cable companies, you see it with just about every, you know, with banks, you know, you see it with, you know, everywhere you look where there's, you know, you have to deal with some kind of large scale corporation for the most part, you know, you're running into sort of, you know, overcharging, overpricing, fewer consumer rights, can't go to court, have to be in arbitration. And he's basically saying that, you know, that all these rules are the result, you know, of basically, you know, the wealthy folk who've been financing campaigns who basically get legislators to, you know, to pass stuff at the federal level that basically, you know, enable profits here while others pay the cost there. And now he, of course, is hoping that this will lead, you know, he thinks that this is what's fueling Bernie's campaign. He thinks this is what's fueling some of the sort of anger that Trump is tapping into, you know, on the immigration front. But really, you know, this is, you know, he thinks we're going to approach a tipping point. Now, I don't, and things, someone will get into the federal government and there'll be some rebalancing. And I just don't know. I mean, I don't know what you think about that. But, you know, but this is what people, I think he's really correct that this is what people are feeling. You know, not everybody has a six-figure job with stock options.
Right. Right. Well, and I'm intrigued, and I looked at Robert Reich's stuff that you've carried through on the Internet, and he's in your neck of the woods. And I assume he's part of the, at least tangentially, part of your team there. But I don't know why he would write a book called Saving Capitalism. I mean, who really wants to save capitalism?
Well, this is so interesting. You know, it's sometimes I think people choose these titles. And, you know, it's sort of like when Elizabeth Warren gave, I think they have to sort of pay some degree of lip service to the other side so that their point will be taken slightly more seriously. I mean, Elizabeth Warren gave a big speech this week also on you know, civil rights and police violence and exploitive, you know, economic things. And she's always has to put in there, you know, we got to praise the police. Yeah, I mean, I think that being a cop is an awful job a lot of the time, but I mean, but it somehow dilutes the fact that there's too much over policing, there's too much aggression. The criminal justice system is biased against, you know, people of color and especially blacks. And if every time you sort of like dilute that, you know, I don't see how it helps us like really get closer to, you know, real solutions. And so yeah, you know, but he basically says that when, you know, he believes that when monopolies thrive, small business people can't, and that's generally true. So, you know, he's trying to strike that middle ground. And but
yeah, but God, I don't know. I mean, is capitalism more serious? I mean, it'd be fun to see a debate between him and Naomi Klein, who's, you know, become very anti-capitalist and all that stuff. But I just don't. I read Robert Reich's stuff, and I find him very interesting. I think he's a really smart guy. And I'm sure he's put many of the right things into this discussion, but I'm just a little wary of the title. I was talking with Steve Rosenfeld, the politics editor at Alternet. Steve, I know that you, as usual, the time is just flying by. I know you have a friend who came out with a book that really interested me about slavery. And
oh, my God.
Slavery,
yeah.
Slavery is still very current. as a topic for a lot of reasons, because we're really just coming to grips in many ways with this Black Lives Matters, with the realities of racism in this country. And I don't think Americans, even to this day, understand how bad and how unique American slavery has been. Now, your friend's book is called what?
It's coming out. It comes out today. I have some pieces. We'll have some excerpts that'll run in the next day or so over alternate. It's called The American Slave Coast, A History of the Slave Breeding Industry. And, until I have talked, over the years with this fellow, his name is Ned Sublett. He and his wife, they're cultural historians, his wife Connie or Constance. Until I talked to Ned about some of this stuff over the years, I just had no idea. And let me just tell your audience how Ned came to this. Ned is a trained musician who basically started looking, he's in his 60s now. He started looking at why the music in the Afro-Caribbean, Afro-Latin music was different from African-American music. Why does the music in New Orleans sound different than the music in Mississippi and the rest of the South? And the short answer to that is it was the conditions of slavery. It was what happened, not just what instruments people could play, but it's like what happened to the families. And basically what he has done in his books, and he's written books on how five waves of different slave importation created the culture that is New Orleans, and it's not the South because it mostly was French and Spanish colonialism. So he has spent 15 years basically trying to figure out and wrestle with what was American slavery all about, and what it was it really like, and how did it shape this country? And this book is just astounding. I mean, the thing about it is that slaves were the major form of money in America for over 150 years. There was no gold. There was no silver. There just were pieces of paper that were slips of credit tied to owning slaves. And when slaves had children, those were considered dividends and interest. And unlike French and Spanish colonialism, where they allowed slave families to stay together and people to buy their freedom, the Americans, broke up families because it was a better investment strategy. They didn't, and you had people, like Thomas Jefferson, who were writing how, well, the blacks are just, they just don't feel the same. They don't experience emotions the same way. It's a better investment than real estate. So what ends up happening is, in Ned's book, he talks about how different southern states or southern territories had They had different competing economic systems based on different types of slave exploitation. Virginia was a slave breeding economy where basically slaves, it was breeding. Women were forced to have sex with other men. The children when they grew up were sold. And part of the expansion to the West was creating new markets for, their product, newly bred slaves. The Carolinas, especially Charleston, was the center of slave importation and exportation. I mean, Harvey, did you know that in the late 1600s, the way the South was primarily emptied of Native Americans was where they were a large numbers of them were captured and sold as slaves for the Caribbean plantations, making room for the kidnapped Africans to come in. Charleston was the epicenter of this. And what ended up happening, and this is where it echoes to, it's like there are these American archetypes that come forward today. I mean, what ended up happening was, after the U.S. became independent, the War of Independence, there was a slave revolution in Haiti. And it lasted like more than a dozen years, I think 13 years, and started in 1790 something and ended in 1804, and it was every American slave owner's worst nightmare that somehow the blacks would rise up and grab their guns and kill them because of what they subjected them to under slavery. And does this sound familiar? You know, you know.
And
what happened? What happened was Thomas Jefferson from Virginia, whose state was competing with South Carolina, convinced Congress that all these French terrorist Negroes were going to invade America, and therefore we had to ban importing slaves. And then from 1808 until the Civil War, all that slavery in the United States was basically a slave breeding industry where the politics of westward expansion were driven by creating new markets to sell slaves that were raised, you know, along the Atlantic coast.
Right, and the major crop was cotton. And one of the reasons Virginia became more of a breeding state was because tobacco declined as a cash crop relative to cotton. Cotton was really the biggest crop in America.
When you start thinking about this history and like how, like, okay, so Ned, in this book, you got to have him on. He talks about how protecting slavery was a big part of the debate around drafting the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And one big factor around the Second Amendment, which I've never heard anybody talk about, is the Southern states wanted the militias that were protected. They wanted to go after escaped slaves. You know, I mean,
yep.
And you know, so you have that, and then after the Civil War, it becomes the Ku Klux Klan, and then it becomes, you know, it's just like, you know, and that, you know, you wonder, like, where does America's obsession with violence and racism, you know, and guns, and, like, you know, and extremely cruel, you know, like, you know, racist criminal justice systems, where does it all come from?
Well, a lot of it comes from the balance of power. You have, you know, really since the very beginning, since the late 1600s, there's always been between 10 and 20% of the population in North America, in what's the United States now, has been black. And that there has always been a question of the balance of power. Now, I've read some very interesting analyses in the late 1600s, 1675. There was a revolt in Virginia called Bacon's Revolt.
Yeah.
And a dissident white landowner got black and white indentured servants together and overthrew the government. And the response to that among the white plantation owners was to really invent a slavery system that would completely put blacks in a separate caste from white, and so that there would never, ever be again a unity of blacks and whites. And then, you know, after the Civil War, you did have the rise of the populist movement, where free blacks did unite with poor whites, and you know, the ruling elite freaked out, and that's where Jim Crow really did come from in the 1890s. And then after the Civil Rights Movement, you know, in the 1960s, finally, it looks like blacks are going to get their civil rights, and you have the Voting Rights Act and the 24th Amendment banning the poll tax, and it looks like blacks are going to finally get some political power. And in 1970, what does Richard Nixon do? He declares the drug war. And, you know, the drug war is really a Jim Crow apparatus. 31 million people have been arrested in the United States since 1970 for drugs. You have to figure about 60% were black. So you figure around 18 million black men, almost all men, were arrested, thrown in prison instead of college. Can you imagine what the country would be like, the United States would be like today, if those, say, 18 million black men had gone to college instead of prison? You know, it's a totally other world.
Yeah,
but this book, what is the name of the book?
Yeah, I'll give you his it's called The American Slave Coast. You know, it's not light reading. I mean, but it's like, you know, if you really care about history and you really want to understand what's going on here, It's the stories. It's the other half that people, you know, that, you know, the mainstream traditional historians didn't want to tell. I mean, you know, the story of slavery is presented as being an amoral but sort of cheap labor system. It was just so much worse than that. And you know, there are these archetypes that persist today. I mean, Jefferson, you know, who wrote All Men Are Created Equal and Everybody, you know, he vehemently argued until he died, for, you know, starting in the 1880s until he died, I think, in the 1840s, or
no, he died in 1826.
Okay,
he
I got that. John, yeah, he,
real quickly,
he vehemently argued.
Well, wait, Steve, you should know this. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams died on July 4th, 1826, within hours of each other. It was the 50th anniversary of the Declaration.
Right.
So there you go.
He argued that the only way – he argued that American slaves could not be freed because some portion of them would take up arms and annihilate the slave owners, the whites. So what he advocated for was basically a mass expulsion, you know, sort of like a combination of like ethnic cleansing and deportation. And he wrote letters and letters saying it would cost this many millions of dollars and require this many dozens of ships and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, and it's, I mean, we're hearing Trump say the same kind of stuff.
Yeah. And what's really amazing about Jefferson is that so many of the black people that he was saying this about were his children. He had five black children with Sally Hemings.
Yeah.
And, you know, how do these guys say these kinds of things about their own biological children? It's mind-boggling to me.
Well, he owned his children, and the weird race laws at the time, I mean, it wasn't very different than the way, like, the Nazis determined whether you were a Jew or not. I mean, it followed the mother. Some of Jefferson's children, slave children, were 7/8 white, but because the mother, you know, had, like, was one, you know, was one quarter black, they were considered slaves.
Well, what I love about this, and part of the dialogue about race, which still is so such a dominant topic in our society, is that two of Jefferson's five children, I've seen different figures, but he and Sally Hemings had a boy in Paris. And he actually moved out to Ohio. He's in the census book here. His name is Thomas Woodson. He changed his name. But they had four kids, at least, that lived at Monticello. And two of them passed for white. And so you have to wonder. Now, Sally Hemings' grandmother was an African. And then she was raped by her white owner. And the daughter she had was then raped by her white owner. And then she had Sally Hemings. And Sally Hemings, of course, I mean, Tom was 30 years older than she was. They had at least five kids. Two of them passed for white and kind of disappeared into white Southern society. And you have to wonder, all these guys running around from the Ku Klux Klan, you know, lynching black people, how many of them had black ancestors? You know, I bet it's a very high percentage.
It is a very high percentage. It's absolutely true.
So there you go. We're talking with Steve Rosenfeld, the editor, politics editor at Alternet. We only have a few minutes left. Stephen, I wanted to get to back a little bit to talk about what we're expecting in 2016. And one of the things that bothers me about the dialogue about electronic voting and the likelihood of theft is that people don't talk about the Senate and the House races. And, you know, they can win or lose the presidential race, but we still have to deal with the Congress. And I know Greg Powis did some very good analysis on the Senate races in this past off-year election, and he said basically that three U.S. Senate races were clearly stolen, including the one in North Carolina, the very pivotal race with Kay Hagan. What have you concluded about that?
Well, I'm embarrassed to say that I don't know enough about the details of those to really talk beyond, you know, generalities. I mean, you know, the race that Kay Hagan was in, you know, followed the most radical change in voting laws in years and years and years. The Republicans came in and they did everything they did in Ohio in 2004 and more.
Yeah.
And you know, but you know, it's so, unless you're there, it's really hard, you know, and like can really dig through stuff. It's really hard to say, you know, with certainty as an outsider.
Right. Let's talk about one more thing here. You recently had a piece up, Nine Amazing Moments from Liz Warren's Speech. We were talking about race. Let's go back to that. What is it that Liz Warren has said that you found so powerful? Your piece, which ran September 28th, Nine Amazing Moments from Liz Warren's Speech Attacking Racism. policing, voter suppression, and predatory economics. What stands out about Liz Warren on this?
Well, I just think that I was happy to see that she connected, connected these issues that a lot of people like to treat as if they're silos and they don't touch each other and one doesn't relate to the other. And, you know, and then she just said some strong stuff, you know, stuff that, you know, you expect her to be strong. But she really, you know, she hit the cops hard for police violence. She said this is America, not a war zone. And policing practices, you know, need to reflect that. And then she just went on and she hit hard, you know, on the racist barriers in voting laws. And she didn't really hold back. I mean, she went after the Supreme Court. She went after, you know, the Republicans, you know, she basically said, you know, all the things that make sense. She listed all the things that are obvious and make sense and should be done, but are not being done, such as making Election Day a holiday. And she said, why? She said, you know, if you want, you know, people, you know, like the fast food workers and people who are paid by the hour to vote, you can't have voting on a Tuesday. And then, you know, she kind of tied it, you know, all of this to, like, you know, the mindset that also creates racist economic policies and practice. And what do I mean by that? You know, it's just the sort of predatory nature of a lot of institutions to systematically strip wealth, you know, either out of people or communities, and especially communities of color. So, you know, you kind of expect liberal Liz Warren from Massachusetts to give a liberal speech, but it was a strong speech, and it was a good overall analysis of tying together, you know, some big things.
Well, good for her. I mean, you wonder if she would ever emerge somehow as a candidate. She's a lot younger than Bernie Sanders. But I guess she's made it pretty clear she's not interested in running for president. It's getting a little late now. Let me do some of the points that she made here. Well, one thing I wondered, you know, how many people do cops actually kill every year? That would be an interesting statistic.
Oh, God, I don't know the number off the top of my head. I've done some reporting on stuff. But it's a lot, you know, the problem is that If a police officer feels threatened, he or she's allowed to use deadly force. There are a lot of people who are mentally ill on the street, and the cops don't know how to handle them. And that's where a lot of the numbers come from.
Yeah, and of course it was Reagan who opened up all the places where people with mental problems were being handled. We've been talking with Steve Rosenfeld. Steve, give us, real quickly, we're almost at the end here, give us an email or a website where you can be reached.
Well, I'm at, you know, iStuff is on alternet.org, and, you know, I'm Stephen with a V at alternet.org. That's my email address. And,
All right, very good. We're trying to go at the end, Steve. But, yeah, bye. Great to talk with you. We'll be back in Philadelphia next week. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you so much.
Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.